Good evening, and welcome to Radio PRS. I'm your co-host for this evening, Jessica Dolan. Mike Ranton has the night off tonight. Radio PRS is brought to you by the Psychical Research Society of Kansas City. PRS is a not-for-profit organization whose purposes include programs and activities to investigate, study, research, demonstrate, discuss, interpret, and expand information concerning psychic phenomena, parapsychology, and related subjects, and to disseminate information by any and all media of communication. The Psychical Research Society is not just an organization for those who practice the intuitive arts. We are here for anyone who is interested in exploring the subjects covered in our mission statement. If you would like more information on becoming a member, please visit our website at prskc.org. The views and opinions expressed on Radio PRS do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of PRS, its board, or its membership. Our guest this evening is Kat Wilder, the Feelingist. You can call in and talk with Kat and Mickey about tonight's topic at 646-668-8212. The phone lines will be open in a half an hour. No reading calls tonight, please. And now, here's your host, Mickey Williams.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
I'm glad to have you with us this evening. For those of you out there who don't know, but you probably do, most of you anyway, Jessica is my oldest daughter, and both my girls are home from college for spring break this week. And so we thought, hey, we've had Jessica on as co-host before, and we really had a great time, loved having her then. So welcome back.
Thank you.
You are very welcome, and you did a wonderful job. I am so excited about tonight's episode. Kat Wilder has been a guest with us before. The last time that she was on, we talked about psychometry, which is absolutely a fascinating subject. But tonight, she is here to discuss with us the history, the culture, the tradition of that magical and mysterious group of people in her ancestry, the Romani people, often known as the Gypsies. Welcome tonight, Kat. I'm so glad to have you back with us.
Well, thank you, Nikki. I'm glad to be here.
We're just so pleased, and I'm so excited about this topic. Before we get into the topic, I just want to touch base with you and ask, are there any new and interesting things that you have been up to lately?
I'm really trying to put forth some effort on my book. I really kind of put it on the back shelf, and I really didn't want to, but you know how life gets in the way of things sometimes. So I'm really trying to get that finished so that I can try and get it on the publishing table next year. That's my current project.
That's a wonderful project, and we talked a little bit about that last time. You have so many wonderful gifts, and I know that you have been psychic since birth. You communicated with animals all the way up through your childhood, and you still are an animal communicator. There's just so much, but what I find fascinating, and I'm so excited to talk to you about this evening, is this rich cultural heritage that you have that you can draw on as a part of those gifts. Talk to us just a little bit, first of all, about what is the Romani culture, the Romani people? Give us a little bit of background.
Well, the best place to start is probably to talk about how they got the name Gypsies, because obviously Romani and Gypsy, you think, how in the world did one become the other?
Yes.
They originally, when they immigrated into Europe, they were such an eccentric and elaborately decorated people. They were obviously nomadic and very exotic, and it was thought that these foreigners must be from Egypt because of their dress and their interesting speech. And they got called Egyptians, which got shortened to Egyptians, and then eventually to Gypsies. But, of course, this is a completely incorrect label, as the Romani are not from Egypt at all, but instead probably passed by it or through it from their original place of origin, which was debated for a very long time. It's now generally believed that the Romani have their origins in India, sometime between the 5th and 9th centuries, The Roma began a massive exodus out of India going westward, and this is generally thought to be due to military movements and the westward spread of Islam at the time. And as they moved westward, there seemed to be three distinct different migrations. And going towards, you know, the northern Mesopotamia and eastern boundaries, we have the Ben-speaking group, which were called the Damari, and then we have the southern route, which were the Fen-speaking group, which are the Lamaroven, and then the northern route, which were the Romani. And the Romani are who I'm going to focus on because my ancestors were Irish gypsies. So we're talking about European gypsies, and that's the Romani. And when you talk about the different tribes in different areas of the world, they actually have different subcultures. And most people aren't even familiar with the other subcultures, but we'll focus on the Romani because they're the most well-known.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, that's fascinating to me that the lineage can be traced back to even to India. So obviously, a people that would be nomadic and traveling through so much of the world would affect their culture to such a great extent. When you talk about them passing through, Mesopotamia and Egypt, and then into Europe, as that northern sect did. What an amazing, rich cultural background, even to begin with. So how did this background for the Romani people, how did it evolve after that?
Well, it's originally believed that they actually had Hindu religious beliefs, but as they traveled, that didn't settle well with the areas that they were traveling through. So a lot of the Romani adopted local religions, or they adopted aspects of local religions. But one thing seems to be pretty certain in that they all have a belief in God, which they call Del, and they believe in the devil, which they call Bane. They believe in the power of amulets, charms and talismans, the presence of good and bad luck, the existence of spirits, especially of ones passed on, both good and bad, and the importance of healing ceremonies, rituals, and the power of curses. So whether they took on the local gods or pretended to take on the local gods or stuck with what they originally believed in, they kept these unifying themes. And since they were a nomadic people, they became very close to nature. They had to learn about the plants and the animals that they traveled along with and that they traveled through. And they have a very, very close relationship with nature. Almost all of their spell work and their shamanism is tied to nature. And a lot of their spell work actually includes bodily fluids and plants and herbs and pieces of people's clothing, things like that. Very nature-oriented. And that is very true throughout the entire Romani culture. And we can get into a little bit of spellcraft later, but that's something that they carried with them as nomads. And, of course, you see the picture of the bardos, the wagons that they traveled in. They took everything that they needed to live with them, and some of them are just gorgeous on the inside. I mean, they look like these little mini houses they're racing now.
Oh, yeah, the tiny house movement. I love that.
Yeah, that's kind of what they look like because, you know, a whole family lived in one, and, you know, whenever they parked somewhere, they parked a little caravan or wherever and sold their wares or did their bartering and that kind of thing for their living. That's what they sold out of. That's what they lived out of. And the gypsies have a really interesting belief that whenever you make something by hand, your energy goes into it. And a lot of spiritual people believe this, but the gypsies especially, like if they're making beadwork or if they're making a scarf or they're knitting a dress or what have you, every stitch they might say a blessing, they might say a prayer, they might say a charm, every stitch. And with that belief is that every stitch, that garment becomes more and more powerful. And the more decorations you put on it, you know, you put coins on it, you put beads on it, you put stones on it, every single little accenting item gives it more energy and more power and more spiritual presence. So to give a gift to a family member or to a tribal member or maybe to someone you're betrothed to, the more effort you put into it, the more work you put into it, the more powerful and special it was.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I can understand that, too. The more love, the more of yourself you put into that. I think we can see some of that in our society today, in our, some of our gift-giving traditions. We've gotten really commercial with it, but I know that I, for one, find a gift that is made for me specifically by someone I love. Like my youngest daughter, Emily, she's quite the artist. And when she paints me a picture with her own hands, and since I see auras, I can see that energy in that painting and the love that she put into it. And it does give it more power. I really believe that. And it gives it more, so much more meaning as well, so much more depth of meaning.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree with it also. And I try to do that whenever I make things for people or if I make Reiki stones for people, I try to, you know, put as much effort into them as possible so that they can get the most out of them.
It's beautiful. That's absolutely beautiful. Well, I have a question, though. You talked about the adornments and the decoration that they put onto the things that they make. Do these decorations and adornments, do any of them have specific things that they represent, like the coins or the different stones?
There are a lot of natural things that meant specific things to gypsies. This is, one of my favorite ones is what type of tree is it? It's a thorn tree, but there's a special thorn. And these are the ones that, like, they're like 4 inches long. If you hit them, they just poke the devil out of you. But these thorns were actually a symbol of self-sacrifice. And they were given, usually tied with string or flowers or something like that, and left on somebody's doorstep as a sign of, you know, of good luck, or you know, I'm praying for you, or I'm trying to help you through this bad time, and here's my gift of myself to you. Acorns was another thing. A lot of different stones. They weren't really big on gems and jewelry and things like that, unless it was handmade. And
right.
So you get a lot of, like, just coins, like they would find on their travels, chained together. And that's why you get this vision of, you know, like, you get this vision of Jasmine from Hunchback of Notre Dame, you know, with the coin scarf and everything. But that's not too far from the truth. They did use a lot of coins and buttons and just a lot of weird little items that they would find. And people call them tinkerers or tinkers because they were always making things. They had to sell things when they stopped into towns. And so they would make whatever they could make, even if it was clothespins or, you know, or buttons or clothes or scarves or whatever they could make just to make a living. They would make whatever they could, and they would make it from whatever they could find. And sometimes those things they got from nature, and sometimes they wove them themselves. But it was, you know, pretty, I would say non-elegant, but in my mind it would be a really cool thing to have. So it's kind of a divide there. I mean, it's not going to be anything that looks super fancy, but for the people at the time, I'm sure it looked really exotic, and I'm sure it was to them.
Oh, I'm certain. Yeah, definitely. I would imagine that nomadic lifestyle, particularly with the smaller caravan of houses, the gypsy wagons, would lend itself to a very communal and community-based society as they moved along. Yes, they had their own homes. I would imagine, though, that they really they shared a lot.
They did, and they didn't trust outsiders. They called outsiders gaje, and you weren't allowed to marry outside of the gypsy tribe. You weren't allowed to marry a gaje, which would have been a person of any of the culture that you were in at the time. It didn't have to be like a white person. It could be anybody that wasn't in the gypsy tribe. You were not allowed to marry that person. You weren't allowed to interact with them except to barter. That was the only time you were allowed to interact with them, was for trade. And interestingly enough, when you think of the gypsy fortune teller, which is, they're called Dabardis, the women that told fortunes, they only do it for members outside the gypsy tribe, because the gypsy believed that they were all inherently spiritual and didn't need to have their fortunes told by a member of their own tribe, that they already had that ability within themselves. Now, they did have shamans, and they could be men or women. They had no discrimination, whether it was a man or a woman. They believed it was completely inherited. And so if it was a man, it was a Shivano. If it was a woman, it was a Shivani. But she was the medicine woman, or he was the medicine man of the tribe. But yeah, they did not tell fortunes for each other, only for outsiders.
Wow. I had no idea. I think that's pretty amazing. So that would be one of the forms they would have used to interact with. Oh, wow. And I imagine for the people that came to them for their fortune read, that would be an experience that would definitely be one to cherish, I would think. I'd love to go back in time and do that myself. I would cling to that so much. Oh my gosh. So I have a question for you about the hierarchy and the structure. Was this a more like matriarchal type of society, or more patriarchal, or was it a fairly even split?
They didn't discriminate, except they did have one thing. They have some really weird taboos about women. They made women wear long skirts because they believed that menstruation and birth were very unclean acts, which I think is very interesting when you have this close-knit community, but this part of life and death, they just didn't deal with it very well. They didn't like it. When a woman was menstruating, she had to wash her clothes completely, like, downstream from everybody else. She couldn't even be seen by the rest of the tribe at the time. And if she was giving birth, she had to build her own little tent. They called these bender tents. And if you can think about it, it was really simple little tent, just with bent poles and a, you know, canvas over the top. And she had to stay in that tent until the baby was ready to be baptized. And then once that was done with, they took all of her clothes, all of the blankets, anything that the midwife had to use, and the bender tent itself, and burned it.
They
totally believed it was unclean. And they did the same thing when somebody was about to die. They sent them off to their own little bender tent, and then they were allowed to die there on their own. And they took all their belongings and either gave them away or burned them, because they believed that anything that was unclaimed off of this deceased loved one would allow angry spirits to come back for revenge. And they also believed that if this person was like a widower, that his ghost would come back and torment his lover until she died.
Oh, my.
Wow.
That's a frightening thought. Okay, yeah, that's definitely a belief I can do without for myself personally, but wow. You mentioned menstruation, for example. I wonder if being nomadic people, if maybe that was influenced by maybe passing through, let's say, Israel, for example, ancient Israel, where we know that in more Orthodox ancient Judaism, menstruation for women was seen as very unclean, and they were pretty much ostracized from their household and from their society, and it was not permitted to speak with them. I'm curious. I wonder if that maybe that's an area of the world where they picked up on that from.
It's very possible. There's also some thought that this, you know, black and white division between what was clean and unclean might have come from the possibility that if they were originally from India, that they could have been a caste of people that were entertainers, thieves, and hangmen, which were a subcaste in the Hindu society that were seen as outcasts and unclean, kind of like the grave diggers, you know. And this might have been in the forefront of their mind as they traveled, about this idea of clean and unclean. That's just a thought. It's historic subject here at this point.
Yeah.
Just based on tracing etymology to their backgrounds. But that's a thought as to where that came from. It seems so conflicting to me with everything else that they believe, because, like I said, in their spells, they use bodily fluids. So why is, why is menstruation wrong? Why is it bad, but everything else is okay?
Right. I know exactly where you're going there. I see where you're going. That's definitely curious. And, you know, it also occurs to me that they had to have come through a great deal of plague, a great number of plagues and pestilence, to be nomadic peoples and to survive throughout all of this ancient history where we were so very susceptible to disease, that maybe that's something else that was a factor.
Yeah, well, and they had a fear of devils and angry spirits and curses and things like that. When babies were born, they were given a secret name that only the mother knew until the child was baptized. And this was to confuse any angry spirits that might come to call on the child or to take him away or to do him any harm. And they also did some spellcraft while the woman was pregnant. They would have all these little ritual knots that were tied in ribbons, and they would untie these knots every day. And it was a charm to prevent the umbilical cord from getting tangled around the baby's neck.
Wow.
And so these were little charms that they did because they were afraid of these things happening. And once the child was baptized, then he got his real name, which was used in the Gypsy tribe. And they just baptized him under running water. Everything had to be running water, no standing water. You didn't wash your clothes in standing water. You didn't take a bath. It was always running water. So it had to be a river or something like that. And then
makes some sense to me from an energy perspective. Running water represents moving energy going forward. Stagnant water, we know, is a breeding ground for bacteria and mosquitoes. And energy-wise, just represents stagnation and doesn't represent growth. Yeah. I can understand that from both points of view.
The colonists weren't doing it, but the gypsies were. And then, if they didn't travel a lot, like if they had a certain area that they stayed in, they would actually give the child a third name that they used in the outer community that was never used in the gypsy tribe. It was like his third name. It was like his Gaujo name. It was like, this is the name that you call yourself to the traders and the barterers that you're going to be dealing with. That way, nobody ever knew their true names. They were really into this idea of deception. In fact, they almost thought it was like a game. It was fun. There's an author, Isabel Fonseca. She writes this book, Bury Me Standing. It's about gypsies and their journey across the continent. And it's so funny. It says gypsies lie. They lie a lot, more often and more inventively than other people, not to each other, but to the Gaje. But malice is not intended, and on the whole, the lying is a cheerful affair. Embellishments are intended to give pleasure, and people long to tell you what they imagine you want to hear. They want to amuse you, they want to amuse themselves, and they want to show you a good time. This is beyond hospitality. It's an art. But lies, of course, are designed to deceive. Indeed, deception, the gentler the better, is considered a duty. I just find that interesting.
That's fascinating. It really is. That's very interesting because I never would have considered that to be a motivation for any type of deception. But I'm thinking about modern storytelling and movies and theater and acting, you know, in general. And I'm thinking about performance art. And I'm thinking it's something similar. It's a very similar thing.
Well, and I hate to even use this word, but you've heard the term, you know, well, I got gypped. You know, that came from gypsies. And gypsies were, you know, thought of by a lot of people to be thieves and cheaters and things like that. And there's an interesting practice that they used to do where they would take their horses. Now, they had really fine horses. The horses were their prized animals. They loved their horses more than any other animal. And when they took a horse to market, they trained him in gypsy. Okay? So they used Romani commands for this horse. And they'd take him to market, and they'd whisper these Romani commands, and they'd make him dance, and they'd make him do all these things, and the people would be just like, oh, this is a wonderful horse. How much do you want? You know? And they'd sell the horse, and then the person would take the horse home, and the horse wouldn't do anything they told it to do. And they were like, well, this is a crap deal. So they would sell the horse back to the gypsy. And he ended up making money by selling these horses back and forth because they had trained them not to listen to outside commands.
That's fascinating.
And
well,
so they kind of...
brilliant, brilliant animals.
Yeah, and so they got gypped. Which, you know, they got gypped up out of a deal, which, you know, as a Romani person, you would probably take that as an offensive term, but that's what happened, and that's how they made a lot of money doing that.
Right, and that's, and that's the evolution of language. Wow. That's fascinating. And I never would have connected that word. Wow, that's very interesting. So tell me a little bit, if you would, about how did the Romani people, because I do know there are Romani, obviously, here in the new continents, you know, north and south America, North America especially. How did they come to be here?
Well, you know, I think they immigrated just like everybody else. Like I said, my ancestors were Irish, so they immigrated over with the Irish, and that's where my family came from. I think, you know, just like a lot of people, they were just looking for a better life, and a lot of them were trying to escape Europe during World War II because the Romani, like the Jews, were considered, you know, a non-Aryan race and were put into concentration camps and just superb numbers. You wouldn't believe the numbers. They don't talk about it because Jews are usually the focus when you talk about concentration camps. And,
right.
You know,
there were a massive number of different types of ethnicities.
But, yeah, the Romani were a very, very large portion of that population, so I think a lot of them were probably trying to escape that. I don't blame them.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I don't blame them either. Yes, exactly. Well, yeah, I know that I remember growing up and learning about the Holocaust and mainly, yeah, hearing about the slaughter of the Jewish people. And it's all absolutely heart-wrenching, and it's horrible. But I also remember being surprised when I was older, and I think I was in high school, and learning that the Romani and the Greeks, that's another group of people that the Nazis were not fond of, many, many different ethnicities of people and different religions that were forced into these horrible concentration camps. And, oh, my goodness. What an awful, awful ordeal. And, you know, we say never again, but it happens in many places in the world, unfortunately, and has happened since then. And
it's
heart-wrenching.
It's just like I told my husband, it's one of those, you know, it's one of those places I would kind of like to visit, but I'm afraid that the spiritual energy there would be so overwhelming that I wouldn't be able to handle it.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me, if you would, a little bit more about some of their shamanic and natural connections and practices.
Well, they believed in divining for water and natural resources and things like that. They also believed in signs and omens in nature. You know, a fork in the road meant, you know, one thing to a Romani tribe and another thing to another Romani tribe. They were very much into, like, hedge magic, I guess, would be the best way to put it. They used a lot of natural remedies for things. They used a lot of plants and herbs and oils and perfumes and things like that in their spellcraft. They also did a specific chant when they were doing their magic that had a certain rhythm that kind of puts you in a trance so that you're getting into that spiritual mode where they could do their spiritual work without having to focus on their thoughts and be distracted and that kind of thing. And it's a certain rhythmic, it's not a pentameter, but it's a certain rhythmic pattern that keeps your brain moving at a certain pace and keeps you focused on natural healing.
Right.
They did throw stones. They did, you know, read bones. They believed a lot about animal folklore. They didn't mind dogs. Occasionally they would eat them. They didn't mind dogs in the camp, but cats were considered extremely unlucky. And if a child brought a stray cat into the camp, they were, you know, told to send it on its way, and then they were scrubbed clean for like an hour because cats were just not a spiritually good animal for them. They do a lot of dream magic. Gypsies believe a lot about dream symbolism. For instance, like if you dreamt of a spider, it meant that opportunities were coming your way. And if it was in a web, then that meant that opportunities could come from several directions because of the strands of the web were coming from several directions. And if you saw a mother spider with lots of baby spiders, then you were coming into wealth because it was like it was birthing these other opportunities. So you were coming into
wealth. Well, I'm going to put that out to the universe tonight. I'm going to try to get some dreams of mother spiders with lots of babies. I'm going to manifest that. Totally.
Yeah, they definitely believed in dream interpretation. They did so many charms. You wouldn't believe the number of charms and things that they did. If somebody let's say a young gypsy woman wanted a man to fall in love with her. She would write their names on a ribbon and tie several knots in it, meaning that she was binding the two of them together. And if she could do this on a piece of his clothing, it was even better. She could get a piece of, like, one of his pant legs or a scarf or something like that. That was even better. And then put it under his bed. And that was supposed to be a charm to draw him to her. And parents could do the same thing if they were wanting to bear a boy or a girl child.
Interesting. That's very fascinating. That sounds a lot like some of the spell work that I've done in for myself and others in the past. That's very interesting. The knots seem to be a recurring theme.
Yes, it is. The knot was very, very important, and it was a binding thing for them, and they used it in a lot of different spells. Love spells especially, just like I just mentioned. But also, you know, if you wanted someone to leave you alone, if you wanted someone to get out of your life, something like that, you could use a knot binding spell for that as well. And if you wanted someone to remember you while they were away, then you wore a knot with their name in it in your shirt. So, I mean, there's just all these recurring themes with knots. And they also had a lot of symbols that they used that they would draw on charms or on rocks or on trees or different things that represented different symbolisms for them. Like, there was one for healing that looks kind of like a snake with a heart for a head. And that represented healing. And, you know, if they painted that on somebody's door or on a scarf and, you know, put it in their home or wore it on their person, that would supposedly help to, you know, progress the healing process.
That is, I find that fascinating, and I find it interesting in comparatively in my mind to not only different magical practices of today, but of other cultures as well, and the interesting use of symbolism in so many cultures in there, whether they be shamanic or other types of ritual magical practices, how symbolism is so prevalent throughout human history in general, and how it seems to really help to focus the energy, the intended energy, the intention of the spell or the prayer or the meditation in so much of history. I'm just finding this fascinating comparatively in my mind, because it just proves to me there's a lot of similarity in our rich traditions as human beings.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Very much so. This is fascinating. So you mentioned a couple of forms of divination earlier, like, for example, throwing stones. Tell us a little bit more about that. And about, I know that they use a lot of divination. Tell us a little bit more about their types of divination or forms of divination.
Oh, they had tons. instead of, you know, like throwing runes or, you know, casting stones or whatever, what they would do is they had a circular cloth that was divided like a tic-tac-toe board. And each section of the board represented a time frame and a location and a closeness to the person and a relation to the person. And then they would cast, you know, it could be beans, could be rocks, could be coins, could be acorns, whatever it was that that DeBarty was using at the time. And then she would read it on that board as they fell on the squares. And it was usually like a leather circle that they drew this little board on. That was pretty popular. Of course, they read cards. They, you know, they read palms. We all know that. And there are some other interesting little things that they did within their own community. Like, if a girl wanted to know the name of her future lover, she would peel an apple. You know, I can't do this, but peel an apple where you peel it all off in one peeling. You know how it's like one strip? I can't do that, but but
I can't
they would
do
that. And then they would throw the peeling on the floor, and then whatever initials it spelled out was the initials of their future mate.
Interesting. I've actually seen a derivation of that on an old episode of Charmed. Loved that show.
Yeah.
Where they,
that's
but
funny.
They threw it into a barrel of water, and it would take the shape of the first the initial of their the who they were meant to be. That's interesting, and I bet you anything that's where they got that from.
Yeah, what's even funnier is you can find a similar variation of that in a lot of middle schools.
Really?
Yeah, that was a big thing when I was in middle school.
Which wasn't that long ago.
No, it was not. About 6 or 7 years ago.
There was another one where a girl would eat a salted egg before she went to bed, and that night she was supposed to have a dream of a man bringing her water, and the man bringing her water would be her future husband.
Interesting. Wow. That, you know, and that again goes to show their reliance on dreams and dream interpretation. Wow. That's
felt the spiritual realm right there.
Wow, that's really amazing. I keep thinking of some of the crazy dreams I have, and I have the weirdest dreams in the world, I'm thoroughly convinced. You mentioned spiders earlier, and I thought about one I had years ago about a chorus line of tap dancing spiders, and I wondered how they would interpret that. But, you know, I'm just Nikki, and I'm a little strange. Oh, this is so fascinating. You also mentioned reading bones. Tell us more about that, because that's definitely a rare form of divination. I know some people use today, but I don't know a lot about it.
It's actually a lot simpler than it sounds. A lot of times, the bones that they would use, they would interpret them based on the animals that they came from. Let's say you had, you know, like a raccoon leg bone and a chicken wing bone and a rabbit shoulder bone, and you threw those. And if the leg bone came up upside down, that might mean that you needed some support in your life. Or, you know, if the shoulder bone sat kind of crooked or sideways, that might mean one thing or another. Or, you know, a lot of times they would relate it to the animals. And if it was a rabbit, they might relate it to speed and cunning and things that you associate with that. Or if it was a bear, they might relate it to strength and power and fortitude and health. They would never use any part of a horse, because that was taboo. But I'm sure they probably used cats, unfortunately. so maybe that was a dark rune for them. If you got a cat bone, maybe you were in trouble. But it depended on, you know, on how it landed. And a lot of times they would put their own symbolism on the bones, on different sides of it. Like, you know, their symbols for health and vitality, or wealth and fortune and strength and power and money and these kinds of things. That way, depending on how the bones fell, you knew whether they were up or down, or if they were cockeyed, or, you know, they needed a little help, or they were sitting straight up like they were supposed to be and everything was perfect, and they would read them like that. Sometimes they would throw them on the mat like they did the beans or the bones, or the beans or the stones or the rocks or whatever, and read it that way. Bone reading is an interesting divination tool. A lot of people are turned off by it just because they think it's kind of morbid. But it gives a really detailed reading. My sister does bone runes. And I have my own set. And you'll find that some people are drawn to them and some people are not. And the people that are drawn to them, I just kind of use it for those people and save it to the side for those who are not. Some people are like, nah, I'm not really going into that area there. they just think it's a little scary, but it's not scary. It's just natural, and that's where it came from. It's just natural magic and natural energies, and it's nothing, you know, they didn't use any animal parts that weren't already probably being used by the camp anyway. You know, they didn't just kill animals
right.
just for their bones. You know, it was like Native Americans. They used what they had, so.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense, particularly as nomadic peoples, that they would use whatever resources were available to them.
Exactly,
that
yeah.
makes sense. So I know we talked a little bit about it, like, for example, the origin of the term being gypped. But in so many parts of the world, gypsies there's a very negative stigma and connotation associated with gypsies, including, you know, here in the United States and many, many places. What is it that led to that?
I think a lot of it has come from, you know, this idea that they're thieves and you know, this... the stories about the horse trading and, you know, that they set up their caravans at night and only bartered with the men that left the town at night. So it was kind of considered like, why are these men going out at night to do this instead of in the middle of the day? I think it just became associated with kind of a forbidden thing just because of that. I think it went against Christian culture, and so the combination of these guys sneaking off at night to have their fortunes read or have somebody dance for them or whatever, and then buying horses and having to sell them back, that kind of thing, I think it just kind of gave them this bad name. And also the fact that they didn't want to interact with outsiders. I mean, people probably thought that that the Romani thought they were better than everybody else. And it wasn't really about that. It was more that they didn't want to mix the bloodlines. They were very close-knit. And you can marry into another gypsy tribe. That was fine. So it wasn't about inbreeding or anything like that. It was just that you had to stay within the Romani culture. And,
well, we've
seen
that throughout history with many different groups. You know, we see that still today with many different groups of people. So it's not like it was something that was an exclusive practice for them.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't know why they got such a bad name. I think probably just because they were so different.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
A lot of us
know what that's like, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, there aren't any people in the world like them. I mean, except for maybe the ancient Egyptians themselves. I can't think of anybody that's as out there as the Romani people are.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and we have seen time and time again in human culture that we tend to fear what we don't understand. Anything that is different to what we consider, quote, normal, quote. I say quotes because, hey, what's your definition of normal, right? we see that so often in societies throughout human history. That it's amazing to me that as a society and as a culture, they have persevered, they have survived, and that we can know these things about their traditions and their heritage and their culture, because the majority of cultures that we know a lot about is due to, there's a great deal on record, you know, and you can dig it all up. Ancient Egypt, you know, for example, in the tombs, and we have their writings and we have their belongings because they were very structured in many ways. But it's amazing to me that we can still have this knowledge and this wisdom, this Romani wisdom today.
Well, it's thanks to, in a great part to etymologists who have studied language and studied where the language came from and the different dialects and how they developed, and without that we probably wouldn't have anything, because when a person died, they burned their wagon down and got rid of their belongings and everything, so you don't have a written history. You just have a verbal history, and that's it. And trying to find, you know, a Romani dictionary is like trying to find a needle in a haystack, because you'll find 12 books that will all say they're a Romani dictionary and have 12 different meanings for the same word.
Being a nomadic people, they would have evolved their language differently from tribe to tribe, I would think.
Yeah, it's nearly impossible to find anything that's going to do you any good. Believe me, I've tried.
Wow. But still, this is just wonderful. You have a wealth of knowledge. I want to thank you for sharing that with us tonight. Let me give you an opportunity to share with us your contact information, because you have so many wonderful services that you offer. How can people get a hold of you?
You can email me at thefeelinist@yahoo.com, and it's all lowercase, so it's nice and easy. Or you can go to my website, which is www.thefeelinist.webs.com. It's also easy, and you can message me through the website if you don't want to email. You can make it anonymous. It doesn't make any difference to me. and there's... there's a phone number on there, and it's 816-944-0735, and that's my business number. And if you get voicemail, don't be discouraged. Just leave your information, and I'll call you back.
Wonderful. Well, I will be back with you in just a minute for any last thoughts and words that you have to share with us right now. Let me tell you guys what's coming up in PRS over the next several months. On March 19th at 7 p.m., we have Mikao Usui. I'm a Reiki master, and I can pronounce it correctly. Mikao Usui Reiki Crystal Awakening with Dear Heart Energy. The program includes a Reiki attunement. For everyone that comes, you're going to absolutely love that. April 16th at 7 p.m., we have Dr. Stephen Summers with Past Life Regression. That includes a group past life regression, so that's going to be a lot of fun, too. May 21st at 7 p.m., we have Susan McKenzie. June 18th, 7 p.m., Matthew Gaines of Alternative Pathways. All of our programs are at the Westwood Community Center at 4700 Rainbow Boulevard in Westwood, Kansas. For all of our members, all the programs are free, but they're also open to the public, the general public, for a $5 fee. So we hope to see you guys at all of our upcoming events. Right here next week on Radio PRS, Christy Stuckey is going to be with us, and we are doing an entire show devoted only to readings. So I know I've had a couple of people call in earlier this evening who are like, Are you doing readings tonight? Not tonight. But we have next week, we have the whole show available for readings. And Christy is wonderful. She was on our show several months ago. She's a wonderful intuitive and energy worker. Just love her to pieces. The following week, we have, let's see, who do we have on the schedule? I've got such a long schedule now, I don't even know who's there anymore. All right, so on March, that would be, that would take us to March 16th. On March the 23rd, we have Susan Prowse. Oh, my gosh, this is wonderful. Susan is an amazing intuitive and artist, and she does so many other wonderful things. You're going to really enjoy her. And on March the 30th, we have Mandy Nagel of Brain Fitness. We're going to be talking about the metaphysical side of brain fitness and neuroplasticity. And what I've kind of dubbed is neurometaphysics. I'm really excited about that as well. It's going to be so much fun. We have a great month on Radio PRS. Several great programs coming up at PRS for our monthly programs. If you want to know more about PRS, about how to become a member, about how to come to our events, what's going on, you can check us out at prskc.org. Also remember that this show and all of our other shows are archived. So if you know anybody who wanted to catch the show and didn't get to listen to it, they can catch it at any time at blogtalkradio.com/prskcradio. They're always there for your listening enjoyment. So, yes, definitely make sure you tune in next week. Thank you so much again, Kat. I have learned so much. And I know, Jessica, I know you were over there just soaking up all the knowledge.
Oh, yes.
she's quite the student of history, and she also loves sociology and anthropology, so this is fascinating her as well. Thank you so much for sharing all of this knowledge with us. We really appreciate you and have been so glad to have you again.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great to be here, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, again, we love having you. Do you have anything that you would like to add before we sign off tonight?
I can't think of anything.
That's okay.
I'm about brain dead now.
I understand that. How about any kind of Romani words of wisdom or maybe a little piece of advice that you can give us, Romani-inspired advice?
I would say definitely with the solar eclipse, I would say your dreams this week are probably going to be extra powerful.
Oh, wow, definitely. Yeah, mine have already been way off the charts crazy, I tell you what. If I ever kept a dream journal, somebody would make some of them into a movie. I swear to Pete they would. Well, again, thank you so much to Kat Wilder for being here this evening. Thank you to Jessica Dolan for being our co-host tonight. You've done a wonderful job, Jessica, and we're glad to have you back. Mike will be back with us next week. Thank you so much to the Psychical Research Society of Kansas City for bringing us this wonderful program every week. Love you guys, always. And thank you very much to all of you out there who tune in and listen. Be sure to share this with anyone and everyone that you think will find it interesting, and I know they will because I definitely have. Have a beautiful and blessed evening.